Hello and welcome to the Now Spinning Magazine podcast with me, Phil Aston. And in this episode, I'm absolutely delighted to be joined by Carl Palmer, legendary drummer of Emerson, Lake & Palmer, Asia, Atomic Rooster, Arthur Brown, and of course the Carl Palmer ELP Legacy as well. So welcome, Carl, and thank you for joining me.
Oh, good to be with you, Phil.
Thank you. Now, there's a new 3CD and DVD career-spanning box set which goes over literally six decades of your fantastic career and also includes a 200-page biography as well. This looks a complete labour of love. I mean, were you heavily involved in picking out all the tracks for this?
Well, I mean, basically, the autobiography that is in there was started, I think, way back in the mid-80s.
Yeah.
And I started recording, you know, my life's sort of experiences, musical experiences, and people I'd worked with on this little dictaphone.
Oh, yeah.
That I started carrying around. So instead of typing it in on the computer or typewriter or whatever I was using at the time,
yeah.
As I say, it was the beginning of the 80s. So I did it on a dictaphone just because there was a better flow with me remembering what happened. Some of the dates, obviously, I got wrong at the time and had to be rectified later on. But the autobiography then sort of took on another lease of life with BMG. Certain bits they took out of it for various reasons. It would have been probably, you know, another sort of 100 pages near enough. But anyway, very happy with what happened with that. Then most of the music really that you're listening to is really to do with the band that I had, which is Carl Palmer's ELP Legacy, or it was just known as the Carl Palmer Band when I started way back in, when was that? That was 2001
yeah,
way back. Anyway, it's a long time. I tend to forget the dates. So, you know, there's a lot of recordings that happened then, live recordings mainly. So we decided to put it together in one box set, along with a Blu-ray DVD, which was kind of a documentary, really, of my career, you know, various things that I've done throughout the years, and put it all together in a box set, which, you know, we ended up doing. I think the book will be available as an individual item, you know, later on, maybe early next year. But we figured this was a good package. As you probably know, Phil, the ELP catalogue is with BMG.
That's right.
So this is how it all sort of came together from the start, because they were very keen to keep all of us in-house if they could. And I was only too pleased to you know, to stay on with them.
I absolutely love it, and I think that the book, including a full biography in a box set, is quite unique. I've never seen that before, so it's a fantastic read for all of you listening to this. I'd like to start at the beginning of CD number two, actually, which is the band The Craig, which was obviously first called The King Bees. And the reason is, I'm originally from Birmingham myself, and I wanted to ask you, I know we're going back a long time, but because a lot of people think about, when they think of the 60s, they think of Liverpool. But the Birmingham scene was just as important, wasn't it, at that time?
To be honest with you, I think, you know, obviously there were a lot of groups that came out of Liverpool, as we all know.
Yeah.
But if you start to look at the groups and musicians, individuals that came out of Birmingham, which was a very industrial town, you know, Americans always ask me, you know, what part of England I'm from. When I explain it to them, I always sort of classify it next to Detroit, because Detroit made motor cars.
Yeah, that's a good one, yeah.
And obviously Birmingham did too, with Jaguar and Land Rover and so forth. So I think what happened there, because it was such an industrialized town, lots of places for people to go to experience music, lots of different styles of music. I think, you know, you ended up, you know, having quite a gathering of musicians, of really first-class musicians. There was lots of places for people to learn their craft. And I remember growing up in Handsworth Wood.
Yeah.
And I remember sort of when I was like 10, 12 years old, you know, there were so many different places that my dad used to take me to, whether it be a jazz club over in Streatley, or whether it be the Locarno Ballroom in the middle of Birmingham.
I remember that.
or whether it be the Plaza Handsworth, with, you know, which was another ballroom, which was just up the road from where I lived, opposite Rookery Road School. You know, there was all of these places. And then if you put all of that together with the various clubs that they had going, you can look at the musicians. You know, you've got Black Sabbath came out of there. There was ELO came out of there, Stevie Winwood. I mean, you name it, it goes on and on and on. The Moody Blues.
Yeah, the Move.
You know, the Move, that, which was the Move who were Carl Wayne and the Vikings originally, when I used to tour in England, in Birmingham. I was in the King Bees. It was Carl Wayne and the Vikings, and there was a band called the Cheetahs. And, you know, there was the Regan circuit, where this woman, Mrs. Regan, had all these various ballrooms scattered around the Birmingham area, from Smethwick to Handsworth Wood, all over. I mean, I think she had about seven of them. Wow. And there was just a load of places to play, so a lot of experience to be had, and a lot of great musicians. I do remember a place called the Chapel Tavern in Livery Street used to have a jam session every Saturday lunchtime, and I ended up going up there. I was about 14, I think. And I sat in with this, like, traditional sort of, like, jazz band, really.
Wow.
I knew that type of music very well, because I'd been in several little jazz groups before. And anyway, it was on that particular day that when the piano player turned round and looked at me, it was, not young, but he's about 2 or 3 years older than me, was Steve Winwood. So it was very, very easy, you know, to run into sort of lots and lots of people, you know. The only person I never got to see in Birmingham who is still a really good friend of mine, and we meet up regularly, was Tony Iommi. By the time I left Birmingham, I think back in 1966 I left, the end of, 65, 60, that's right, I had my 16th birthday in London. I think Tony was still playing in, you know, he got the band together, I think, and they were still playing in the garage and stuff. They weren't actually doing gigs. So I never got to see Sabbath until I played California Jam in America. Black Sabbath were on the same bill.
Yeah,
I think Purple and ELP had co-headlining. But, you know, he became a good friend, Tony. And as I say, there's just so many great musicians. I mean, just take Jeff Lynne for one, you know, just remarkable. And John Bonham, who became a very good friend when I was in Chris Farlow and the Thunderbirds, which was my first group I played with in London when I left home and came down here. I was with Chris Farlow for 2 years, and when I decided to leave and go on to the crazy world of Arthur Brown, I asked Chris, I said, if it doesn't work out, can I come back? And he said, well, I've never had that question asked before. I said, well, you know, I like the music that they play in the crazy world of Arthur Brown. I'm not too sure if I'm going to enjoy working in America, which was where they were quite big, because they had the number one single there, you know. So he said, yes. He said, but there is one condition. He said, you have to find a drummer. So I said, well, I can definitely find a drummer. I said, if that's all I have to do. So he said, yeah, if you find a drummer and it doesn't work out for you with the crazy world of Arthur Brown, he said, you know, I'll let you come back in. So I asked John Bonham, to come down. You know, we'd played opposite each other. He was in the Crawling Kingsnakes, I think, some band like that. And he was, you know, he's really good, John. And I said, come down. Anyway, John got the job with Chris Farlow. I think he stayed for about 3 months. And then he got a call from Robert Plant saying he'd been contacted by Jimmy Page, and they were going to form a band. And, you know, I think John said, oh, I'll come down and give it a go then. Well, he didn't have to go down, because he was already up in London. And I think that's where the first auditions took place, was Zeppelin in the Surrey area, I believe.
Yeah.
But don't quote me on that.
That's okay.
So, I mean, a lot of great memories, a lot of great musicians, musicians who did incredibly well on a global level, you know, apart from having major recording success.
Yeah, and the one thing you mentioned when you were talking there is the fact that you were heavily influenced by jazz. And around this time, if you're a guitarist, you're influenced by blues music. Now, all the guitarists, whether they were Tony Iommi or Ritchie Blackmore or Jimmy Page, were influenced by the blues. But if you were a drummer, it seems to be, from that period, it was jazz, wasn't it? So Bonham,
it just seemed
Pace,
to be the better players were the jazz players. Yeah. It's not to say that there weren't great rock drummers. I mean, you know, James Brown had some great great drummers. I mean, there were great rock drummers, but they weren't readily available to hear. You know, you couldn't really sort of get to sort of hear them play something a bit more interesting. It was basically backing the singer. But jazz drummers, you know, were backing soloists, so they could stretch out more. You would learn more. And I mean, we had some great drummers in England anyway. People like Kenny Clare, who's one of the greatest sort of jazz drummers, big band drummers that we ever produced here in the UK, who I actually tried to get lessons from, but it didn't happen, unfortunately. But the jazz drummers were definitely the best. I mean, my dad used to take me to whatever jazz club there were. There was one over in Digbeth, the Digbeth City Hall. I went to see many jazz groups there, Humphrey Littleton, somewhere in Stetchley, I think there was a jazz club. I saw Phil Seaman, who was another great, great drummer. And then, you know, a guy that I had lessons off was a chap called Lionel Rubin, who used to be on the television on a program called Lunchbox every lunchtime, the Jerry Allen Trio, and he was another great jazz drummer. So there was an incredible amount of talent in Birmingham.
And when you join Emerson, Lake and Palmer, you're still only 20 years old, aren't you?
Yes, I just formed the Atomic Rooster. The Atomic Rooster had been together about 8 months. Yeah. We were doing quite well, and we just left Arthur in America because things were going wrong there. Came back, and I said, you know, that I'm going to form a band. And before I knew it, Vincent Crane was on the same plane as me. He said, I'm coming back as well. I can't wait around any longer. So I said, fine. I said, well, let's do it together. You take care of writing some music. Let's get some ideas going. And I'll see if I can find somebody to manage us and get us on the right track. And I did. I ended up finding Robert Stigwood, who was very interested in the band. And I think we signed a deal with BNC Records. And that was it. And, you know, the Atomic Rooster did very well. They had a number one single called Tomorrow Night.
Yeah, blue track.
I had recorded as a demo prior to leaving. And, of course, I was sitting in the rehearsal room 8 months later or 6 months later with Keith and Greg, and the Atomic Rooster were number one with Tomorrow Night. Obviously, they had to re-record it with their new drummer. And it was at that stage I thought, maybe I made a mistake here, you know.
Because although you just talked about the jazz influences, and obviously lots of drummers around you were also influenced by jazz, but I think one of the things that maybe sets you out to be different is you were also influenced by classical music, weren't you? You wanted to be a musical drummer.
My grandfather was a professor of music at the Royal Academy in London. He taught harmony and, I believe, violin.
Yeah.
And in our house, you know, there was a lot of jazz, there was a lot of classical. My great-great-grandmother was a classical guitarist. My grandfather was a classical percussionist. My other grandfather, who kind of lived in the same house as us, was a classical violin player, come conductor. He conducted at the London Palladium, the Palm Court Orchestra, as well as teaching at the Royal Academy. And he got me interested in classical music, and he used to sit me down and play, you know, The Rite of Spring by Stravinsky and, you know, Tchaikovsky and things like this. And I really enjoyed that type of music early on. And then my dad would have all these great jazz albums by Earl Gardner and Dave Brubeck and you name it, so Oscar Peterson, and it went on like that. So I kind of grew up in that world, really. It wasn't until my eldest brother, Jimmy, who was a guitar player, and he was in the Locarno Orchestra in Birmingham, where I played a few times, he brought the greatest hits by Elvis Presley. And I remember playing that, and I couldn't believe it, to tell you the truth. I thought, wow, this music's interesting. And that's what sort of kicked it off. And I think by the time I was 14, I'd had several jobs in Birmingham and in Wolverhampton, playing at the Pear Tree Club and stuff and doing all of that. And I saw an advert in the Birmingham Mail for a group wanted a drummer. and they were called the King Bees. And I found out they were rehearsing at the Plaza Handsworth, which was a Mrs. Regan place. And the orchestra that played in this ballroom was called the Charlie Simpson Orchestra, which my eldest brother knew, Jimmy knew, he knew Charlie Simpson very well. So anyway, in the daytime, the King Bees had got the rehearsal space on the main stage to audition drummers. Anyway, by the time I saw the ad, I thought, well, I'll go up and have a look, see if anyone's actually there rehearsing. When I got there, they had just finished. They'd played with, I think, two or three drummers. And I asked them if I could play. They said, well, we're thinking of packing up now. So I said, well, you know, I said, I can use the drum set that's on the stage because that belongs to the drummer who plays in the big band here. I said, it won't be a problem. They said, well, okay, but you need to learn some songs and so we can just see what you do. So I said, okay, fine. So what they did was they gave me this pile, say a pile, about four or five singles with a chalk mark on each side. And they said, look, learn those and then come back. So I said, okay. I said, how long are you going to be here for? So they said, well, we're going to the fish and chip shop across the road. We're going to be here at least another hour, you know. Yeah. So I said, oh, okay, fine. Well, I only live 10 minutes away walking. I ran home like, you know, hell in the night, put these on, listened to them. I thought, God, this is easy. And I charted it out, you know, because by then I could read music very well. I charted four of the five out. I thought, well, I'll just get up there, listen to the fifth piece. I thought, well, I'll busk that one. I'll be able to play that, I'm sure, because it's simple. Got up there and said, I'm ready. They said, what do you mean? I said, well, I can play these five tunes with you if you want to give me a shot. And I played them, and they said, you're in. I said, that's fantastic. I said, you don't use music then, you just learn it by heart, because I'd only ever been in bands where there was music involved. So they said, no, you just got to learn them like that. We buy singles and we all learn them. And if we change them, we change them all together so we know what the arrangements are, and that's how we do it. So they said, well, you know, Saturday we need you. So I said, oh, I can't do that. I said, I can't come for another 10 days, possibly 2 weeks, because I have to give you my notice at two different jobs I got. I got a residency at the Perry Bar Working Man's Club, and I got another residency at the Pear Tree Club in Wolverhampton. My dad used to drive me over there. So they said, well, oh, okay, all right. Well, okay, but we've got to have a start date from you. So the following day, I rang through to, I think, Jeff Brown, who was a lead singer, rhythm guitar player. I rang through a date when I could start, and then they rearranged how they dealt with their business. And then I started with the King Bees. My dad wasn't very, very pleased, but when he came to a concert, he saw how happy I was. He just said, well, you know, get on with it and see how it goes, you know, and that was it. And that was my intro to playing in a rock band, really. And I think all that got me, to be honest with you, Phil, was when I heard the Vox amplifiers, and I've actually got an EC30 here in the house, when I heard those Vox amplifiers going away and I was sitting in between them, I thought, oh, this is a bit of me. I need this, you know. And I was smitten straight away. I was in, you know, Smokestack Lightning, Howling Wolf, and I'm a King Bee, and all those kind of things we used to play. I thought, it is lovely, because it was R&B, really. It was close to jazz, so it was close to my heart, and there was a little few sort of Tamla songs in there, a bit rocky. I thought, yeah, I'm in, and that was it.
So one of the things you mentioned there is that you learned to read music so you could obviously sight read. Is that obviously through the 70s and 80s it was quite unusual for anyone in a band to actually read music. Everything was done by feel and remembering, so improvisation. So being a drummer who could read music must set you quite a way apart from many of your contemporaries, I would imagine.
Yeah, well, I mean, it came about. I mean, I never set out to learn to read music. It was just a case of my parents, you know, were quite happy for me to go into to the music world and play, because there was a lot of music in the family.
Yeah.
They realised I didn't want to work in the retail shops that we owned, because we had a couple of retail shops in Dudley. We also had a stall in Dudley and a stall in Cannock. You know, they realised I didn't want to do that. But there was so much music in the family. They said, well, if you become a musician, you need to buy some insurance and you need to learn to read music so you can go and do Broadway shows or join a classical orchestra or do this or do that. So that's how they viewed it. And then obviously when I started to learn to read, and I had various teachers in the Birmingham area, I really found it incredibly interesting, you know, unbelievably interesting. And it rode my boat, as they say. And when ELP was formed, I mean, Keith Emerson was a very, very good reader of music too. So, you know, I wasn't the only person who could read music that I ever played with. There's quite a few of them, but they didn't really talk about it because it was a little bit sort of, you're not meant to sort of do things like that. You're meant to be a rocker and, you know, just learn it by ear and play, which we all did as well. Well, you know, so we having both the, you know, the sort of understanding to be able to write it down so you know what you play and just learn it by ear, you know, by developing your sensitivities and things to the music and, you know, hearing stuff and being able to play it, you know, that was a big advantage as well. So having the two, you know, really, really helped me basically throughout my career.
So Keith and Greg, or Keith especially, though, is a few years older than you, and obviously, as you say, he was an incredible musician. But I remember reading that how much you had an influence on Keith when it came to putting together Tarkus, because you were interested in time signatures like 5, 4, 9, 8.
Yeah. And yeah, I wonder. Well, so what happened there with Tarkus? I had basically this rhythm which I played to Keith, and where the accents were in this 10-8 or 5-4, however you'd like to look at it, I said that really could be where the melody should start with, on these accents. That should be the kicking off point to build a melody if it works. And he tried it and it did work, and you know, we worked together sort of a lot like that, really. I mean, Keith was a great musician, and he was always open to the rhythmical side of music as much as he, you know, could possibly be. You know, for him it was very important, because the piano is a percussive instrument. Yes, anyway. Yes. So we hit off on many points, to tell you the truth. In actual fact, just as a matter of interest, I wasn't the first drummer with Keith and Greg. The first drummer at the audition was Mitch Mitchell from the Jimi Hendrix Experience.
Really? Yeah, I
don't know quite what happened there, but I got the call from Keith's manager at the time, when Keith had a band called The Nice. Stratton Smith, I believe, was the manager, and he called me and said, would I like to come down and play? I didn't know who Stratton Smith was. He told me he was a manager of The Nice, and I think what happened was something went wrong with Mitch. I'm not exactly sure, because I was a big Mitch Mitchell fan anyway. Something went wrong there, and then I got the call from Stratton Smith, and he told me what it was all about, and I was sort of, I suppose I was the young gun in town at the time, you know, that's for sure. Playing with Arthur Brown and coming back with the Atomic Rooster, it was that they just looked around for, you know, whoever was the, you know, the most powerful, the youngest, and the best at the time, I suppose. And that's how I got the offer. I was a little bit put back, because I'd just signed up to buy a brand new Mercedes van with the Stigwood organisation, and I'd taken out some money to buy, put down on this van and things. And I thought, you know, I can't start jumping ship now. But as time went by, you know, I think it took about 2 months for me finally to make up my mind, and I went over. First of all, I said no, and then Greg Lake got on the phone and was really, you know, not pushy, but saying, hey, you know, I think we can make this work, and I think this will be unbelievable. Let's not miss the chance, you know. And it went on like that. And anyway, cut a long story short, you know, history is well written, well documented. I ended up joining them, and that was it.
But also, you continued to carry on with your family's kind of enthusiasm for you to be a fully rounded musician, in that by the time you were doing Brain Salad Surgery, by this time the band's huge, but you continue to have lessons. You were with Gilbert Webster at the Guildhall School of Music, so you continually wanted to you know, further your skills as a proper musical drummer.
Yeah, well, to be honest with you, it's like I said, Phil, you know, once I learned to read basic sort of drum music, you know, you get quite enthusiastic about it and you get, you know, quite inquisitive. So I thought, you know, I'd like to just, though I might never use it, I'd like to just sort of know how to play timps, and I'd like to know how to tune them in thirds and fifths of how do you do that? And I'd like to learn to play that last part on the timpani of the Rite of Spring, you know, and it went on like that. And I went to the Royal Academy, to James Blades, and I went to the Guildhall and studied some xylophone with Gilbert Webster. So it was really just, you know, being super inquisitive. And don't forget, ELP was a classically driven the group anyway, and I was really into classical music. I mean, that's where Keith and I hit it off. I mean, though Keith had already experimented with classical pieces with the Nice, which was fantastic, I was really into people like Jacques Lussier, who played like Bach in a jazz trio, and he did such a great job. I mean, I just loved it, you know, and I love that Dave Brubeck album Time Out, which had sort of like classical sort of influence pieces on it. And of course, you know, what Keith was doing, I really, you know, one of my favourite groups was the Nice. Yeah. So when I ended up playing with Keith, it just brought everything together that I was learning or wanted to learn or directions I wanted to go in was all there in one hit, you know. So it was a lot of fun. And I just stayed on that inquisitive sort of part. I'll learn as much as what I possibly can all of the time, you know. And that's what happened.
Well, I want to now go to the first track on CD1, which is Concerto for Percussion, which you did with Joseph Horowitz.
Yes.
Now, this was recorded at the same time as Works Volume 1, so, and, but obviously wasn't included, but it's one hell of an outtake. It's absolutely an incredible piece of music.
Yeah, well, I mean, what happened there was we decided that we wanted to make a double album, have a side each, and one side for the group, which was ended up being Pirates, which was like this epic piece. Well, Keith had already started on a piano concerto, so I thought, you know, maybe I should see if I could get, you know, a percussion concerto. I mean, Evelyn Glennie had been doing a little bit of that or experimenting, but no one had had one written for them. I mean, I couldn't write it all because it would just be too much for me. But I could write all the parts, you know, for the timpani, for the xylophone. I could do all of that. But the actual themes and really getting something that would be of a level, you know, it would be better to hand it over to someone else. And, you know, two heads are better than one type of thing. So Joseph Horowitz was a composer, teacher at the Royal College of Music.
Yeah.
I think he actually taught Rick Wakeman harmony, to tell you the truth, years ago. Anyway, I decided that that's what I would do. So I recorded that particular piece, and I recorded lots of individual tracks because we had so much time off at the time.
Yeah.
And when it came to putting the album together, you know, I think we tossed a coin, and we couldn't have two concertos on this double vinyl. It was at the time. We could only have one because it would be a bit too much. We thought, I mean, we were used to taking chances, but we didn't really want to do that. So I think it was like a toss of a coin, and Keith got it, and he got his concerto on there, and I kept mine back for a later date, as it were.
Because what one of the things I feel, and this is just a personal observation, is that if I go back to 1977, I'm personally 18 when this comes out. Punk is going on in the UK. The age of the audience for ELP is probably around teenagers or people in their late 20s, early 30s. And most of our moms and dads listen to classical music and stuff. But a lot of the people I was growing up with didn't. Now, from where I am now, looking back through the lens of time, and a lot of the people I know around me, we all appreciate classical music. It almost feels like Emerson, Lake and Palmer were way ahead of their time, that the audience at the time was too young to appreciate what it was that was being put down in front of them. I mean, I'm thinking of Keith's piano concerto, which is immaculate and now is being seen more by the classical world as being, you know, a brilliant composition, and your concerto percussion, when I, because that was the first thing I played on the box set, and I just thought, oh my god, I thought, where this is just amazing. But as you say, at the time, it would have been perhaps too much. But
I mean,
now,
it never got picked up by an orchestra for an orchestra. I mean, I played all of the parts, but the concerto never got picked up at the time by an orchestra because they said, how can you have a percussion concerto? Well, you know, there are tuned percussion instruments like vibraphones, xylophones, glockenspiels, tubular bells. You can play tunes as well as, like, you know, hitting a drum type of thing. So what's the problem? Anyway, it went against the grain as far as the real sort of classical heads were concerned. And it was considered to be something, you know, really bizarre. And a lot of people, you know, couldn't understand why Joseph Horowitz wanted to do it. In actual fact, the first chap that I chose to help me was a guy called Andre Panufnik, who was like a huge sort of like name in the classical world here in England, as far as he was Polish, but he was an unbelievable writer and he'd written so many great things. And he said, Carl, he said, you know, I just don't see that. Well, if you roll on from the 70, if you roll on from the time I did that 76, like 10 years or whatever, within that 10 years, Evelyn Glennie had already picked up the second movement from my percussion concerto and she was playing it. You know, people had already started to warm to it. They just didn't want to be able to play it all because it's a bit tricky. And I suppose you've got to divide what I played between four people, and you need to have an actual drum set with concert tom-toms, you know, the 6, 8, 10, 12, 14, and whatever. You need those there. So the special equipment needed. There were tuned crotales, which are tiny little thick discs of roughly about 6 to 7 inches in diameter, and they're tuned. There were things like that, tuned gongs. There was a specialist equipment that was needed as well. So it never really, you know, rang the bell quite as loud as what I would have liked it to have done, but it will always be there, and it will be picked up eventually. And, you know, I know that another one of the movements has been played by another orchestra in, I think it's the fourth movement, I think it's been played by an orchestra in, is it Germany or America? Anyway, so it's been picked up. So, but at the time, it was really considered an oddball, risque thing to do. But, I mean, that's what music is all about, isn't it? Trying to push the boundaries if you
Absolutely. And the other ingredient, of course, that you had, apart from all this musical training, is you were a showman. I mean, where did all that come from?
Well, it came from, you know, my dad took me to, where was it now? It was one of Mrs. Regan's concerts, ballrooms, but it might have been in Stetchley. Anyway, he took me to one of these ballrooms. In the Birmingham area, we had lots of ballrooms where people actually did formation dancing and Latin American dancing, and they'd have a proper orchestra. Anyway, he took me to one of these ballrooms. That was a Regan venue, Mrs. Regan's venue, and I saw a group, a man called Eric Delaney. And Eric Delaney was a drummer, and he had two bass drums. This was, can you imagine? This was in like 1963. He had two bass drums, all of these tom-toms, thousands of cymbals, timpani on stage, and he had a revolving drum riser.
Wow.
And I saw this guy. I thought he was a complete nutter. I couldn't believe it. I said, I've got it. I said to my dad, I said, I love all of this. I said, this is great. And he said, yeah. He said, it's good as long as you learn to play. He said, if you want to, he didn't use the word eye candy, meaning, you know, if you wanted to, it looked better. He used some other word at the time, but that's what he was insinuating. Yeah, as long as you learn to play properly, then you can do whatever you want. And he said, you just can't be flashy for the sake of being flashy. You need to be able to play incredibly well as well. So I kind of took that as a bit of a lead from Eric Delaney. And once I got with Keith Emerson, when he started sticking daggers in his organ and riding the keyboard across the L100 across the stage and things, I thought, you know, I've got to smarten up here and get things going. And that's where the two gongs happened, and the revolving drum riser and all that stuff. And I just decided that I would build as much into my playing at the right time as possible, which was really the whole ethos of ELP. We always thought that the music should stand up on its own without a vocal. If we add a vocal, it should take it to another level. And once we've done that, if we can actually make the music more exciting by adding slides or screens or whatever visuals we could, then we should consider that. And that's how it all came about. So it was part of our general makeup as three people, actually.
Fantastic. Now, many musicians only have one bite of the apple, but you obviously had several. But you, another highlight of your career is Asia. Now, this is very different to MS Lake and Palm, but the quality of the music and performances was just as incredible, and in no small part, perhaps, because of John Wetton. What was it like working with John?
John Wetton was probably one of my, I hate to say best friends because that sounds a bit like a teenager, but John Wetton was really a great, great friend. He actually came along, I mean, we went back years. He actually came along to audition for Atomic Rooster.
Oh, wow.
And I passed on him. Actually, the same Steve Howe also came along to audition for Atomic Rooster, and we passed on him. Shows you what I knew then. Yeah. But anyway, John was just incredible to work with. The albums towards the end with John, the albums that came out on Frontiers, got a little bit too middle of the road for me, and we had a few arguments, and I said I would play live concerts, but I didn't really want to record anything that middle of the road. But the first three albums, and the first album and the second album especially, the writing was just iconic, and it was just fantastic.
Totally.
And when John called me up and said, you know, do you want to come around and listen to some stuff that I've got, when I went round, I mean, I was just sort of bowled over. And he was being managed by a chap called Brian Lane, who was also the manager for Yes at the time. And that's how Steve Howe came into the web. And obviously, you know, there was Jeff Downs, really, I think, was still in the Buggles at that stage.
Yeah.
And he was in the same rehearsal room that Steve, John and myself were playing. And we heard these keyboards down the hallway, and it was Jeff Downs. And we went down and pulled him up and asked him to join. But John Wetton was the key sort of writer, the top line writer. He was just unbelievable. And he had an uncanny thing about him, John. I remember being in the studio over in Ladbroke Grove somewhere, and it was about 12 o'clock at night, you know, we were all getting ready to go home. And he said, I've got this one piece. He said, it'd be really easy to learn. He said, I haven't played it to anyone yet. He said, but have a listen to this. And he played us this song. It was called Heat of the Moment. And it was a bit like a country and western song.
Really? Wow.
I said, that's weird, isn't it? I said, it's in 3/4. I said, do you really want to? I said, he said, no. He said, it's not going to be in 3/4. It's going to be in 4/4. But I want you to play this drum beat in each one of the spaces. Boom, 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 blah, boom.
Yeah.
I said, got it. I said, so, well, why don't we just run it down quickly and then we come in and record it tomorrow? Anyway, we started playing it. And you know something, 2:30 in the morning, we got one in the bag, and it was Heat of the Moment, and it was number one for seven weeks in America.
Well, it still sounds absolutely fantastic now, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I mean, the rest of the pieces, you know, Only Time Will Tell, you know, Soul Survivor. I mean, they were all great, great songs.
One of the things I want to touch on before we finish is your artwork, where you've taken the aspect of music and drumming and added a visual aspect to it and then created static artwork from it. I mean, this is, I think, unique. This is, for those of you listening, this is on the DVD if you want more information about it. But how did this come to fruition?
Okay, so basically, I don't mind saying this because there's a lot of people doing it now, but I believe I was the very first person to start this particular art form.
Yeah.
So in 1973,
wow.
I had these light bulbs. I was in Emerson Lake and Palmer then. I had these light bulbs taped to my drumstick with a cable going down to the floor to a battery, and I had it on both sticks. So I couldn't actually play the drums because obviously the light bulbs would be broken or when the lights would go out, it would mean nothing. But I experimented with like waving my hands around, miming as if I was playing. And I was quite intrigued by the amount of movement of light and the kind of shadows that it kind of, you know, caused. anyway, I got the idea from playing with Arthur Brown when we had, I used to have about four strobe lights around my drum set, which drove me crazy and gave me terrible headaches. But I do remember looking up one day and watching the stick go through the strobe light, and it was like it was in slow motion. And I thought, wow, that's interesting, all the shadows and reflections and things. I'll have to see if I could recreate that another way, but have lights on the drumsticks. Anyway, I did this thing in Birmingham. Stuck these light bulbs, these little bulbs from a torch on the end of each stick, and cables down to a battery on the floor, and I mined, and I got a photographer to take some pictures, and he took some pictures, and it ended up in the Evening Standard one of the other papers was in Birmingham, ended up in the paper. Everybody thought I was actually playing, but I wasn't. There was all these arcs of light going backwards and forwards and all around me, and it looked like really futuristic and impressive. Anyway, if you roll forward 40-odd years, the Chinese started making drumsticks with little LED light actually built into the stick. Wow. The stick, which didn't have any cables to batteries down to the floor, as it were, but they were self-generating. When you picked them up, the lights came on. Anyway, there was a company called Scene 4 in Los Angeles called me up and said, we would like to introduce you to this thing we've been doing, and they told me all about it. Oh, I said, I did that back in 73. They said, no, Carl, you never did anything like this. Oh, I said, I did, yeah. I said, but I only had one colour, which was a white light. I said, I've tried the sticks that you're talking about with the colours. I said, but they go out and this. They said, we can't believe you started doing this in 73. So I actually went up into the loft and I found the old picture and I sent it through to them. They said, wow, that's incredible. Could we do something with you? So I said, fine. And I started setting up in a dark room with my drum set, surrounded by curtains, using these light. These are sticks made in China, which are superior now, by the way. Yeah. The last 5 years, they're absolutely fantastic. And I might use a different color in each hand. And I use two cameras now, different shutter speeds, and I get to capture not only the movement of light, but the reflections and shadows that it creates, plus the reflection from the drum set because it's stainless steel. I've always played stainless steel drums. We get some incredible sort of pictures. And I've been doing it now with Scene 4 for just over, 15 years. I think we've given about somewhere between $40,000 and $50,000 to various charities in America. And it's just one of those things that's always intrigued me and stayed with me. And I think I've had two art books out with Scene 4. And I think we're about to do, I've got the title. I'm going to call it Portraits in Percussion. I'm going to do a third sort of catalogue of pieces of art. So I'll probably do that. Probably in the summer this year I'll start. I've got some ideas. So what I end up doing is I end up playing like the rhythm of Tarkus. If you see it in music is one thing, but if you see the way it looks in light, when the actual movement of lights move per note, per accent, it's really incredible when you can capture it the right way. I mean, one canvas, say me playing a piece like Tarkus, might take me 6 to 7 hours to get it right. Not to play it right, but just to get the right camera angles and flap around with the shutter speeds and this and that. But when you get it, it's actually magical because I don't fuss with it afterwards. It's organic, it's as it happened. It's the real thing as it happened in that moment in time. So that's what makes them unique. I mean, plus the fact I only ever do small amounts. If I produce a piece of art, it's like 100 or 500 for the world, not just 500 for Germany, another 500 for France, 1,000 for America. It's usually like 500 for the world, and that's it. And when they're all sold, the plates get taken away, so they can't be printed off again.
No, it's absolutely fantastic, and as you say, you've raised a lot of money with your Art of Giving Foundation. And then CD3, I'll finish on, which is the Carl Palmer Band, Carl Palmer's ELP Legacy, and this is all the live material. Now, these two musicians you've had with you, Paul
Bielatovich and Simon Fitzpatrick.
Yeah, I mean, the way Paul plays the guitar, which is almost like Keith's keyboard, and how the music you generate, the music on this CD, at this part of the box set, is complex, it's exciting, it's progressive, it's it's just amazing. I mean, I think this box set will bring a lot of this to people's ears who maybe have just lived it, not so much in the past with the ELP stuff and Asia stuff, but it will really make them aware of just how amazing your band and the ELP legacy is.
Well, to be honest with you, Phil, the biggest problem that I've had, I mean, we trigger a lot of synthesizer sounds from both guitars.
Oh, yeah.
Or triggers a lot of keyboard sounds, and you can do that now. Technology is that advanced. Simon Fitzpatrick, who plays a six-string bass, and a Chapman stick, which is a 10-stringed instrument, can play chords and the bass line at the same time. Plus, he can trigger synthesizer sounds. And we've got all of that programmed. My biggest problem was, because I wanted to carry on with the Emerson, Lake and Palmer music, because I believed in it so much, you know, from an art point of view. I believed it was really deep, and it was in a sort of area of its own. I didn't really want to have a keyboard player because I figured he'd only ever be compared to Keith. What I needed to do was try and present it in a different way, maybe a bit more exciting in certain ways, you know, and that's why I chose guitar. And it's taken a long time to get it to this standard, but right now, I mean, we're playing to, like, you know, 2,000, 3,000 people a night in America, and I'm really proud of it. And I don't know if you know, but the show that I have right now is I actually play seven songs with Keith and Greg on stage with me on film, and they're perfectly in sync with my drums, and all the keyboards are playing. Keith's up there, Greg's up there, and then I play another six pieces with Simon and Paul. It's all integrated together. But what I do is we had a DVD from the Royal Albert Hall in London, and it was a five-camera shoot.
Wow.
And we had the audio tracks recorded separately, each individual track, all the keyboards, all the voices, all the bass guitars, acoustic, all of the drums. So what I did, I got these tapes, I completely removed my drums. Yeah. I kept all the footage of them singing and playing with the actual audio, and I play my drums live in situ in the venue. So when you hear the band playing, we're mixing all the keyboards because they're on separate tracks. It's Keith Emerson up on the screen playing them. It's Greg Lake singing, and there's the three of us again. So that's what I'm up to now, and it's worked incredibly well, along with having Paul and Simon, you know, where we play other pieces like Tarkus and Carmina Burana together, and sometimes Paul and Simon come out and reinforce some of the ELP tracks that I play with Keith and Greg. So it's turned out to be something, you know, quite magnificent. I'm really pleased with it. It's only because of technology and the fact we recorded a DVD with a separate audio lines, which meant I could take the drums away, add them live on any night, and then remix Keith Emerson's keyboards and Greg's voice into the mix for that night, and have them on screen perfectly in sync playing and singing.
It must be incredibly emotional, not just for you, but for the audience as well, to actually witness that.
It is, to be honest with you. I've had the first 3 weeks, the editing took me to get me out of all the pictures, all of the frames from the original DVD from the Royal Albert Hall. So you wouldn't see me up on the screen with Greg and Keith. You'd see me live on stage, and then that would be projected onto a third screen downstage. Keith and Greg would be left and right. To get to that stage where you never saw me except in the hall playing live, so you knew it was me because I looked that much older. To get to that stage was between 8 to 9 weeks of just editing video footage. You know, that was quite difficult to remove the drums. And it was quite emotional. The first couple of weeks was emotional, and then after that it was a man at work. You know, I just wanted to get it done. I wanted to get it done to the highest standard. I knew that Greg and Keith would really enjoy and appreciate this because I'd investigated the holograms before, and holograms are a bit, you know, they're a bit spooky and they're not real.
No.
And here am I sitting with a DVD, which did get released. It was group approved. It was released on Sanctuary.
Yeah.
got released, and here's Greg and Keith at their very best, at the top of their game, and I can take the drums away because it was all the audio feeds were recorded separately, so why not use that? And that's what I've done, and I've got the new AI program now, and I've managed to improve some of the footage because it was a little bit grainy. Some of it wasn't as sharp as what I would have liked it, but it was the early 90s when we did that gig. It's not exactly IMAX, but it's so good now. I mean, it's good enough to go and show the public, you know.
Yeah, brilliant. Well, the box set Fanfare for the Common Man is out on April the 1st on BMG. And if people want to find you, Carl, do you have your own website? Is it carlpalmer.com?
Yeah, you can go to carlpalmer.com. You know, I'm on Facebook, you know, and all of that. People can always get hold of me or find out what's going on, that's for sure. And we do have a ELP bloggers Facebook page we're starting off, so people can, you know, form some groups or start chatting and, you know, asking questions and things like that. That'll be coming very soon. In actual fact, I think it's made. I think they're going to launch it sometime next week. Yeah, but you can always find out what I'm doing. I'm back in America in July, and hopefully we are trying really, really hard to see if we can get into England and play some dates just here in England, first of all. And let the public see, you know, this new show, which is the return of Everson, Lake and Palmer.
Well, thanks very much, Carl. Thanks for your time this afternoon. It's been wonderful to talk to you, and some great stories. And obviously, the music is just ageless and stands up now just as much as it ever did. In fact, I would say that Emerson, Lake and Palmer's legacy is more relevant now than it's ever been.
Oh, well, that's very nice, Phil. Thank you for the kind words. Very much appreciated.
That's absolutely fine. So thank you. Take care, Carl, and hopefully I'll talk to you again.
Thanks for the interview, Phil.
No problem at all. Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye.
Bye.
A big thank you to my guest, Carl Palmer, from Emerson, Lake & Palmer, Asia, The Crazy World of Arthur Brown, Atomic Rooster, Chris Farlow, Asia. I might have already said that. But what fantastic stories. Wonderful to hear about the Birmingham scene as it was, the stories behind some of the classical music, infused music from ELP, the Asia stories as well, and of course what Carl's doing with his art, the Art of Giving Foundation, Portraits in Percussion, which sounds like a great book, and of course the ELP legacy, where we're able to see Keith and Greg on screen, on stage with Carl, Paul and Simon. So thank you for listening, thank you for being here and subscribing to Now Spinning Magazine, the podcast, the YouTube channel, the website, the Facebook group. Thank you for all of your support, and I look forward to talking to you on the next episode of the Now Spinning Magazine podcast.